A small path had been cut high up on its right bank, and this was our road. Looking up, I discovered from the foot of its sandy cliff a kind of loggia that commanded the view of the gorge from afar, and immediately jumped to the conclusion that sentries might well be posted there to observe travelers. Perhaps it was an old Chinese building. It might indeed have been used by them as a watchtower, but most probably it was now put to another use. I did not, one can well understand, remain there to ascertain the history of that painted balcony. It left me perfectly indifferent. I did not even dare to stop to drink at the rivulet which crossed the path below, although I knew that I might not come across any more water for some miles. I ran and ran, as if flying. Contrary to my custom, which was to let Yongdan march first, so that passers-by could see his face, while I remained more or less hidden behind him and his load, I told him to follow me because the possible danger was now behind us. Thus, if we walked close to each other, the watchman from Uban, if there were any, could discern only the familiar sight of a load surmounted by the red cap of a lama, under which hung a raggy shamdabs. Nevertheless, we endeavored to reach the end of that interminable gorge as quickly as possible. The path, following the windings of the cliff, alternately hid us from the spur on which the upper part of Uban Fort or monastery was situated, and brought us again within sight of it. We took advantage of this circumstance to rest a few minutes when we were sheltered. It seemed like a game, but a tiring, nerve-wracking, meaningless game. The walk without the preoccupations that spoiled it would have been charming. In this country, autumn has the youthful charm of spring. The sun enveloped the scenery in a rosy light that spread joy from the river of opalescent green, flowing swiftly in the depths of the gorge, to the top of the cliffs, on which a few hardy fir trees pointed to the sky. Each pebble on the path seemed to enjoy the warmth of day, and chatted with suppressed laughter under our feet. A Lilliputian shrub that grew on the side of the road perfumed the air with a strong aromatic scent. It was one of those mornings when nature bewitches us with her deceitful magic, when one sinks deep into the bliss of sensation and the joy of living. It is but a short distance between Uban and Larkangra. We did not want to be seen in the latter place and had again planned to cross it at night. We had, therefore, plenty of time, and as soon as we met a stream in a gorge that crossed our path, we halted to take a meal behind some big rocks a little below. Many groups of pilgrims and several lonely travelers passed near us without suspecting our presence. Strangely enough, now that we had crossed the Doka Pass and entered Tibet, the stream of devotees which appeared to have been stopped during the first week of our journey began to flow as usual in that season. We saw, from behind our hiding place, a most picturesque procession of men and women from different parts of eastern and northern Tibet, all making haste to reach Larkangra early and to find room in the primitive inns there. Still, a few stopped as we did, and began to cook bread. We had no wheat flour and hoped they might be willing to sell us a small quantity of their own. Yongdan went to propose this to them, but they had only a very little, and wanted to keep it. A talk followed in which my companion tried to get as much information as possible about the country. As the pilgrimages usually performed thrick, at intervals of several years, some of the travelers we met were able to supply us with very useful information. My companion returned, and we drank a bowl of tea. I was washing my handkerchief in the stream when one of the travelers came over to us and asked the lama to foretell the result of some litigation he had at home. That was the first time during our journey that Yongdan acted in the capacity of a red cap lama, an adept in the art of Mo. Years before, when we traveled in the northern country and I wore my beautiful lama robes, it was I who was requested to bless the people, blow on the sick to cure them, and prophesy about countless things. I performed a few miracles, chants, the faith and the robust constitution of those who were benefited making it difficult to abstain from working wonders, and I had some gratifying success as an oracle. That glorious time was gone. Now I humbly washed our pot in the stream, while Yongdan solemnly revealed to his attentive listeners the secrets of the future concerning a disputed land many hundred miles away. We passed to the left bank of the Larkangra River, and the scenery changed entirely. The gorge had become very narrow and wild. On both sides there were dark cliffs of rock, which might in places have reached 700 or 800 feet in height, leaving only a narrow ribbon of sky visible overhead. Yet the view was far from being gloomy or depressing. Perhaps the pictures painted and carved in large numbers on the rocks modified the character of the place itself. Hundreds of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, famous lamas of yore and deities appeared there, all in the attitude of meditation, their eyes half closed in some inward gaze. That silent, motionless, saintly crowd had created in the dark a very peculiar mental atmosphere. Between the images were engraved large portions of philosophical treatises as well as short mystic sentences or praises of the wisdom of Buddha. I remained for a long time reading here and there, enjoying the serenity conveyed by these old scriptures. I was indeed privileged to experience in a single day the intoxication arising from the beauty of nature and the peaceful delight of the mind brought to the threshold of the supreme deliverance. And thrice blessed verily is the country that can offer both these things to those who tread its ground. A mendonga covered by a roof, which we saw at dusk, might have provided us with shelter for their night, but we thought that we were still far from Lakangra, and therefore continued our way. We crossed the bridge once more. The gorge bent suddenly, and the large sailween spread its green waters in front of us. We were in Lakangra. Although it was nearly dark, we did not dare to turn back. We could have been seen, and it would have seemed strange that pilgrims such as we were supposed to be avoided the village. The best way, as our plans were once more upset, was to spend the night bravely somewhere in a corner like other travelers. We met several people who were camping near a fire, exchanged a few words with them and decided to stay in a small cave situated on there. Road we were to follow the next day. There we should be somewhat sheltered if snow fell. I gathered some twigs and dry cow dung on the road. I stole a few branches from the fences of the neighboring fields, but Ajipas must be cautious in their ways. Unless they halt in the forest, they are taken for thieves if they are seen burning big logs. Tibetan farmers do not like people to pillage the fences that protect the cultivated land from the intrusion of cattle. And in doing so one risks serious thrashings. As we were in a hamlet and night protected us, Yongdan thought that he might well take the opportunity to purchase food. We had lived until then on the supply that we had carried when leaving the mission house. 10 days had elapsed since then, and our bags were nearly empty. I wrapped myself in my thick dress according to the manner of the poor Tibetans, and made a pretense of sleeping to avoid useless talk if, by any chance, someone passed near me, while my companion went toward the houses. The first one he entered happened to be that of the Lairin, in charge of the Lakangra shrine. He was welcomed on his twofold title of colleague and buyer, for the Lama added to his profits as a shrine keeper those he derived from a small shop where pilgrims could revictual and purchase sundry articles of devotion such as incense sticks, small flags bearing mystic drawings or words, etc. They both, by chance, belonged to the same religious sect and subsect. Moreover, the Lama was not a native of the Dot country, his birthplace being in far northern Kham, where Yongdan had long lived with me, and whose dialect he spoke rather well. That coincidence of circumstances made them friends in no time, but the affair was not to end there. Looking round the room, Yongdan saw books on a shelf and asked his permission to have a look at them. This being granted, he read aloud a few lines of the first one he opened. "How beautifully you read," admired the Lama. "Are you able to read any book in that way?"
"Indeed," answered my companion. Then, passing suddenly to another topic, the Lama shopkeeper pressed Yongdan to spend the night in his house, offering to go himself to fetch and carry his luggage. Yongdan refused but, as the Lama insisted, he confessed that he was traveling with his aged mother. This did not in the least cool the good intentions of the kind host. There was room for the mother as well, and it was hard to convince him that, by this time, I was sleeping soundly and was best left alone. Then the Kuna, sacristan, being at a loss to manage the success of the scheme he had in mind, without making it known, was forced to disclose the fact that his hospitable feelings were not altogether disinterested. "Lama," he said to Yongnan, "some villagers have come here from the opposite side of the Jiamonuchu, Sailween, and have asked me to perform the rites for the dead in behalf of one of their relatives who passed away recently. They are wealthy people and would have gone to the Lama of their own country monastery had he not been away in Lhasa. I have been chosen in his place, and it would be very profitable for me, but I am not well read and I am so afraid of making mistakes in placing the ritual offerings and reciting the liturgy in the proper way. I see that you are learned. Perhaps you know these ceremonies."
"I do know them," declared Yongnan.
"Then I beg you to do me the service of staying here 3 days. I shall feed you both and give you some provisions for the road when you set out. The mother might recite Mani, the well-known Om Mani Padme Hum, at the door, and no doubt the villagers will give her some champa." Yongnan declined the proposal on the ground that we belonged to a party of pilgrims who were already ahead. We could not linger behind, but were, on the contrary, compelled to proceed quickly in order to join them and return together to our own country. When my companion returned with a few provisions, he told me of his talk with the Lama, and I rather regretted that the vicinity of the border commanded a hasty progress. I would have enjoyed the fun of reciting Mani at the door. However, the near future was to give me more opportunities to enjoy that kind of fun than I could have ever dreamed of. I should find it hard to recount the number of times I have chanted Mani, outdoors and indoors during my journey. I became rather expert at it, and was complimented twice for the nice way I had of chanting it. Perhaps, after all, Tibet helped me to discover the jewel which dwells in the heart of the lotus. The Konging Lama came in the early morning to talk again with Yongnan. In order to avoid being seen by him, I went down and walked around the shrine for about an hour, putting into motions as I walked each of the many reels which contain tightly rolled bands of the paper on which is printed 1,000 times the mystic sentence, Om Mani Padme Hum. I deemed that morning's walk to be rather superfluous for one who would have to tramp a good number of miles during the day, but I found no better means of getting away, and even so, I did not escape a talk with the Lama, who stopped for a little chat with me on his way back home. Chapter 2. Along the majestic Jiamonuchu, Sailween, the road goes alternately through deep gorges and broad, widening valleys. The scenery in either case remains at once majestic and enchanting. Truly, fear is still thee, crouched in a corner of my heart, ready to spring up. Our stay at La Kangra has been too long. Has the shrine keeper begun to wonder who we are? I observe those who come behind me. Are we not followed, spied upon? That horseman yonder, riding in our direction, is he not a soldier sent to bring us back? Eve, when she was banished from Eden, had explored all its pleasures, and except for these it could afford her no cause for regret. Even if Evia's mind were of a similar cast to mine, she might have found interest in the adventure which opened to her the wide unknown world beyond the enclosure of paradise. But I, her little great-granddaughter, although I had wandered for years in my fairyland, I was far from having exhausted its interests. Had I been compelled to turn back now, I would never have known the new landscape hidden behind the woody hill that shut off my horizon, nor penetrated the mystery beyond that other rose-colored one which stood behind it, nor climbed the pass which, still farther, traced a mauve soft line on the sky between snow-white peaks. Forebodings still arose in my mind only to fade in their powerless nest to disturb the joy of those wonderful hours. A few days after leaving La Kangra, a tragic meeting saddened us. Near the road, in front of the Jiamonuchu, whose icy emerald water appeared in the bright sunlight like a glittering moving mirror, lay an old man, his head resting on a leather bag. When we approached, he gazed at us with vacant eyes, already dull, and with an effort he lifted himself a little, on his elbow. I could see the poor fellow was near his end. Yongnan asked him how he got there alone. The story was simple. The old peasant had left his village with a group of friends to travel round the Kakapo on a pilgrimage. An illness, whose cause he could not understand,
had suddenly deprived him of his strength. He was unable to walk and had to fall behind. His companions had slackened their pace, they had even stopped for a whole day, and then they had gone on their way. Such is the Tibetan custom, even in the desert, where an abandoned sick man, if he cannot reach a doctor's encampment, will die of starvation when once his provisions are exhausted. Nor must one forget the wolves and the bears who roam about. Shall I die? The old man asked Yongden. Lama, cast lots to know. No, you will not die, answered the latter, after having quickly performed the usual rites, in an attempt to cheer up the forlorn traveler. He meant well, but I thought that the glimmer of hope he lighted would soon vanish if, the next morning, the man himself felt still weaker, or if in the darkness of the next night, he realized the approach of death. Then in spite of the promptings of prudence, it became impossible for me to continue my part of the aged, feeble-minded, and beggarly mother. In a few words I reminded him of the simple beliefs of the religion he had followed since his childhood, and promised him, not only this life, but a happy rebirth in the abode of Chenrezigs which awaits those who die while on a pilgrimage, and, after thousands of years spent there in rest and delights, other lives again and again, till he reached the supreme enlightenment that liberates one from the bondage of life as well as of death. He listened to me attentively and piously. He bent low and touched the bottom of my dress with his forehead, as Tibetans do to the Jarmas whom they worship. I believed that a Kandoma or a goddess had seen his distress and assumed the shape of a pilgrim to console him. What mattered, if the illusion enchanted his last hour? Can we help you in any way? I asked him. No, he answered, I have food and money in my bag. I am well here, with the gods. Kalu, we both answered, and we went on our way. I felt that Nubwachn, the land of bliss, shone now before his eyes that began to see but dimly the things of this world. The dying man was carried away by the vision I had evoked and had lost all desire for this life, for which, at first, he had begged my companion so anxiously. We enjoyed a few days of relative tranquility, loitering leisurely along the beautiful valley. We were no longer in a solitary region, as we had been during our tramps in the Kakapo forests. Villages were rather close together, and deeming it still wise to avoid staying overnight amongst Tibetans or even being seen during the daytime by many people, we managed to pass these villages at daybreak or a little earlier. This mode of traveling compelled us to remain long in one of the way and out of sight spots, waiting for the proper time to venture to pass the houses. There was nothing unpleasant in such lazy vagrancy amidst beautiful scenery, favored as we were with fine weather. The only drawback was that it made our progress dreadfully slow. Anyhow, we felt the benefit of these long rests in the jungle after the painful strain to which our nerves had been subjected. But perfect peace was far from our present reach. One morning, when we were imprudently taking our meal in a small cave near the road, a woman aroused the fear latent in our minds. She was a well-dressed lady of rank, covered with jewels. Three maidservants followed her. She stopped before us and asked from what country we bade come. At that time we styled ourselves Mongolian Dokpas of the Northern Koko-Nora Solitudes. Yongden, therefore, answered, we are people from beyond the Blue Lake. She replied, are you Filings, foreigners? I made a pretense of laughing at such an idea, and Yongden stood up to attract the attention of the lady to himself, so that she might, by scanning his regular Mongolian features, be convinced that he had nothing of a Westerner about him. She is my mother, he declared, pointing to me. Then, after a few other questions, the woman went on her way. A little later her husband passed us, riding a superb horse with a silver and gold inlaid saddle. A dozen attendants followed, leading the horses of the lady and her maids. The gentleman did not honor us with even a single glance. Yongden learned from a servant that they all came from a place situated beyond Menkong, and that circumstance added some strength to my resolution to avoid that small town, capital of the Zarong province and seat of a governor. The question asked by the woman had made us most unhappy. So, in spite of the trouble I had taken to powder myself with cocoa and charcoal, in spite of my pretty yokai hair dressing, I did not look Tibetan enough in that calm country where most women have a dark complexion. What more was to be done? It might be also that rumors had been spread about us, after our passage at Lakangra. We did not know what to believe. The jungle had ceased to be charming. I again began to see a spy behind every bush, and the water of the Sailween muttered threatening or mocking words. Then we bethought us that perchance we were alone responsible for the question that the Tibetan lady had asked us. We could not guess the extent of her geographical knowledge. Perhaps she was learned enough to have thought of the Asiatic Russians when Yongdan had mentioned beyond the Blue Lake. But more likely she had confused Tso, lake with Jiatso, ocean, and had understood that we had come from the other side of the Blue Ocean, which was tantamount to saying that we were not Asiatics. That idea reassured us, but we struck out forever from our traveling vocabulary the words Pachola, and transported our mother country a good deal southward. We became natives of Amdo. We were nearing the end of the last gorge before the wide broadening of the valley at the point where our path deserted the Jiamo Niuchu and turned toward the passes that led to the River Niu. Yongdan walked ahead. He had already turned the corner of a rocky headland and was out of my sight, when a well-dressed man coming toward me appeared at the point of the small promontory. The path was exceedingly narrow and when two people met there one of them had to stand aside against the rock to allow the other to pass. With a humility suitable to my part of an Oriental woman and beggar, I had already begun to make room for the traveler, but he stopped suddenly, quickly removing the yin he carried over his shoulder and the sword that was passed through his belt, according to the Tibetan fashion. He first silently bowed down three times, then, with clasped hands and head bent, as when asking the benediction of a lama, he approached me. Astonishment paralyzed thought. I mechanically obeyed an old habit acquired when I lived in Lamaist monasteries, and laid my hands on the manor's head. Before I had sufficiently recovered from my surprise to think of asking him who he was, he had again put on his gun and sword and was gone. I turned to look at him, he strode rapidly along the gorge, and after a few minutes was but a small moving black speck in the gigantic corridor. "Did you see that man?" I inquired of Yongdan as soon as I rejoined him. "Yes," he said. "Did he speak to you?" "No. He only greeted me with the usual." "Do you know him?" "Not in the least." I related to my companion what had just happened, and he concluded that the man had seen that I was an Aljorma. As for me, I suspected that the stranger had formerly met us both somewhere. He had recognized Yongdan and had guessed the identity of the laywoman who followed him clad in plain white clothes. I was very sorry to have let him go without speaking with him. And now, although he had shown me respect by asking my blessing and, therefore, could have no bad intentions toward me, he might tell someone about his meeting and, as he was proceeding in the direction of Aban, such talks might prove dangerous. But Yongdan persisted in saying that he had never seen the man before, that he did not know us in the least, and that he had been prompted by some occult influences. Then he began to tell me several Tibetan stories about similar instances, and soon landed me in the phantasmagoric yet fascinating realm of thought forms, previous lives, and many other kindred topics. But my modest wishes were confined to the desire that, whatever might have been the motive which he had obeyed, my safety might not be endangered by my unknown worshipper. We were now approaching Thana, where we had been told that there existed a frontier station. Trusting the maps and some travel books that I had read, I believed that the Pilgrim's Road turned east toward a twin pass of the Dokola, leading to the Chinese territory on the watershed of the River Mekong. In reality, the path to Menkong, the capital of Zarong, is the only one to branch off of at that place along the Jiamo Niuchu. The one which we were to follow northward forks only at Wabo. I did not know these details and was most preoccupied with the invention of a new story concerning the aim of our journey, as we should be leaving behind the sacred mountain which had until then supplied us with the plausible and respectable motive of performing a religious pilgrimage. I felt almost convinced that, if we kept to the circuitous road, nobody would take any notice of us, for was not that station at Thana probably established precisely in order to observe those who left it to set out for Tibet? I already had visions of barriers, of officials before whom travelers were led to be interrogated. What would that Thana village be like? I was puzzled and anxious. As we were walking toward our fate, good or bad we could not know, we saw a few snowy peaks and a great part of the Kakapo itself, shining marvelously white, which, it pleased me to imagine, bid us a cordial farewell. At that time of year only dry, thorny shrubs were to be seen in the wide valley. The hills were barren and of a light yellow color. On the opposite bank of the river, which flows between high banks, we saw a monastery. We managed to reach Teaya at night. We arranged it even too well that time, it seems, for we were not able to find our way in the dark and arrived near a temple where there were a number of watchdogs, who barked dreadfully at our approach. Happily, they were well shut in and could not escape to attack us. But I feared that people would look out to see who were causing the noise and make certain that they were not thieves. Furthermore, the passage of mysterious strangers in the night held the danger of inquiries about us and the risk of being reported at the station. To avoid this, Yongdan called aloud to the shrinekeeper, asking shelter for the night for a tired Ajopa who had hardly been able to struggle through the last lap of his journey on account of a bad leg. My companion's request was full of pathos and loud enough to be heard all over the temple buildings. During his performance I had hidden myself out of sight. We were practically convinced that the shrine keeper would not get up to receive a beggar at night. We knew our Tibetan Tibetans well enough to risk the trick, being certain of its result. When he had waited long enough, Yongdan went away, lamenting aloud, "Oh, how unkind to leave a poor sick pilgrim out in the cold. How pitiless." And so on. His plaintive voice faded gradually away, as at the opera in songs of supposed passers-by behind the scenes. It was rather a pretty effect amidst natural scenery of standing rocks, along a path that led downward to a stream. I nearly applauded. We had passed the shrine all right. Whoever might have been staying in it would not, on the morrow, give a single thought to the crying beggar of the previous night. But where was the village? In the pitch dark we could not see it and, had we caught sight of houses, we should not have dared to venture in their direction, lest we fall in with dogs of the same species as those who watched over the temple. Yongdan insisted on lying down on the road itself. I preferred to go farther from the temple and find a more comfortable place. Discerning, in the shallow water, some stepping stones which crossed the stream, I went scouting on the other side, where I discovered two caves. We had a house for the rest of the night. What a blessing! We should sleep as if really at home. I ran to fetch my companion, and we installed ourselves in one of the caves, where we ate our supper with the clear, fresh water of the stream as beverage, cool, perhaps, even too cool, and slept the sound sleep of the tired yet happy Tibetan-ness coppers, pilgrims. In the morning, when putting on my upper dress, which I used at night as a blanket, I discovered that I had lost my small compass. This was a most distressing event. First, the compass was useful to me, and, although I had another, I should miss it. But the worst danger was in leaving a foreign object behind us. If it was found, that compass might be talked about all over the country and officials would quickly realize that a foreigner had been staying in that locality. I, 47, spent some really unpleasant minutes searching in the dark for the lost article, which, fortunately, I found before long. Anyhow, we had lost some extremely precious time. At daybreak a servant of the shrine came to fetch water at the stream, and we started in haste. We could now see the village quite near the place where we had slept. The country folk were already awake and busy with their early work, reciting, as they moved to and fro, those various mystic formulae which, in Lamaist lands, take the place which prayers occupy in other countries. Kindling the fire, giving fodder to the cattle, leading horses to drink at the stream, they went on with their muttering. A humming, like that from 100 beehives, enveloped the village, People looked at us from the top of their windows or from their flat roofs. We went along with our heads bent, humming like everybody else. Yongdan inquired about the road from a man near the stream. A few minutes later we were out in the fields.